Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Bring the world closer with podcasts from the BBC World Service. Unmissable stories from around the globe.
Whoa.
Search for The Documentary, Lives Less Ordinary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson. At 1400 hours GMT on Friday the 29th of December, these are our main stories. Deaths are recorded after Russia launches more than 150 missiles across Ukraine. A peace initiative is developing in Cairo as the Israelis continue strikes on Gaza. Also,
my duty and obligation is to uphold the Constitution. And I made the determination that I did. My decision is thorough and based on the rule of law, the facts before me.
Why it's becoming more difficult for Donald Trump to get back into the White House. Also in this podcast, lovers of luxury in Switzerland may soon have to say farewell to foie gras and...
I don't like sharks. That's why I'm sitting on the beach always. I don't go into the water.
How South Africans are taking measures to prevent shark attacks. We start in Ukraine, where the sound of air defence sirens rang out through the night in the capital Kyiv. Then in the morning, the sound of at least three big explosions in the city centre. Mariska Papalushkaita is a journalist who lives in the capital.
Right now, Kyiv is on air alert. And a few minutes before the broadcast, I heard a few loud explosions right here in Kyiv. I'm so stressed right now, but we tried to continue our lives because we have no choice. It's our country, it's our lives. I go to work, I study, I raised my 8-year-old son in all these war conditions. But I feel like I can become a new victim every day because Russia continues to kill us.
And it wasn't just Kyiv under attack. The authorities in Ukraine say Russia has launched a wave of missile strikes across the country, targeting Kharkiv, Lviv, Sumy, Odessa and several other smaller urban areas. There are official reports of at least 18 deaths. The attack came a day after President Zelensky thanked the US for its latest $250 million military aid package, using the last of the money authorised so far. I got more from our correspondent James Waterhouse, who's in Kyiv.
What is clear is that this is a coordinated, widespread attack on Ukraine. And the Air Force, just to give you an idea, is saying it had never seen so many incoming missiles on its monitors. And I think in a war where the whole of Ukraine is routinely targeted by Russian missile and drone attacks, that really is saying something. We've had drone strikes in the western city of Lviv, which often feels far from the conflict, hundreds of miles away from where I am now. In the southern city of Odessa, a high-rise apartment block's been heavily damaged. There are reports of a hospital and shopping centre being hit in the eastern city of Dnipro, northeastern city of Sumy. I could go on. Kharkiv has come under a missile attack, and I think it's the scale of this attack which has seemingly overwhelmed Ukraine's air defences.
So, James, what do you think about the timing of this attack? Because it comes just a day, doesn't it, after President Zelensky thanked the US for its latest approved multi-million dollar military aid package.
There's always a temptation, certainly among Ukrainians you speak to make the connection between other events and attacks like this. And it is true that Russia has responded in this kind of way when things might not have gone Moscow's way in other areas, but it has been a week where Ukraine received the last of an approved US military aid package, $250 million. Yes, it's a lot. It'll replenish ammunition stores, missiles, as well as air defences themselves. But Ukraine will be looking at what it could have had or is yet to have, which is a military package worth more than $50 billion, which is getting caught up in Congress over a political disagreement over whether the funds should be provided or not. So I think that's a reflection of growing scepticism in the West. But it is an uncertain time for Ukraine, because that latter package would enable it, in Kyiv's view, to not just continue to defend itself, but to continue to pursue its dream. And it feels like a dream at the moment. It can change of liberating all of its territory. But it's also been a week where Ukraine struck a major Russian landing vessel in the heart of occupied Crimea, which would have undoubtedly frustrated Russian operations there. So you do wonder if it is retaliation. You can't rule it out, but of course we'll never know for sure.
And what does it tell us about the conflict as it enters its third calendar year?
It is a conflict that is very much in the midst of a stalemate. If you look at the eastern front lines, it is Russia launching wave after wave of attack. We are seeing Russia continue to launch missile strikes that we've just discussed. And there's very little movement in the south as well, where Ukraine had been hoping to punch through at the start of its counteroffensive. We are seeing, yes, strikes, targeted missile strikes deep into occupied Crimea, which, you know, is Ukraine playing the long game, I think. But time is not Ukraine's friend. There are powerful Western politicians who are wanting a faster return for the billions of dollars it's signed up to date. So Ukraine is being pressured to deliver fast results. But 2023 has shown Russia can not only keep attacking, but it can defend what it has taken from Ukraine so far.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. Well, meanwhile, just over the border in Poland, officials say an unidentified object has entered Polish airspace from the direction of Ukraine. Adam Easton sent us this report from Warsaw.
A Polish Armed Forces spokesman said radar picked up the object when it entered the country's airspace from Ukraine, but the signal was subsequently lost. There have been no reports yet the object has been found, nor of any injuries. The spokesman said the event may be linked to Russia's large-scale missile and drone attack overnight against Ukraine. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, at least two missiles have landed in Poland, a member of NATO. In November last year, two farmers were killed after a rocket, believed to have been fired by Ukrainian air defence forces trying to repel a Russian attack, landed in a Polish village near the border.
Adam Easton. There has been no let-up in Israel's airstrikes on Gaza, with nearly 190 people dead in the past 24 hours. 40 of those died as thousands gathered in the southern town of Rafah. This man spoke to us after arriving there.
We are here. We are suffering. No clean bathrooms, no toilets, no food. It was really hard to find wheat. We suffer from everything, also water. We suffer from all sides.
A peace initiative in Cairo is also continuing, which was due to be joined by a delegation from Hamas. I spoke to our correspondent, Yolan Nel, who's in Jerusalem, and I asked her about the Israeli army expanding its operation in the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis.
This is a city that Israel considers to be a main Hamas terror center. That's what it's said in recent days. And it's actually sent an additional military brigade to that city, which has been so much the focus of heavy urban combat. But we're hearing also in the past day or so there have been intense Israeli airstrikes there, continued shelling as well. At least eight people were killed in Khan Yunis in one strike yesterday. We heard about from medics at the hospital there. We had the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, going to Khan Yunis yesterday, and he was talking there about how determination and perseverance would be required. But he said this was an essential stage of Israel's mission to, in his words, destroy Hamas.
So people trying to find somewhere to go, actually, in Gaza. Is there a bottleneck developing, do you think, in Rafah, the southernmost tip of Gaza?
There is in Rafah, and the other city that's really been overwhelmed is Deir al-Balah, which is the main town in the centre of the Gaza Strip. This is because you have tens of thousands of Gazans have been fleeing these three urban refugee camps in the centre of Gaza after they were ordered out by Israeli forces as their tanks advanced from the north and from the east. And so people have been making their way south and west, so to Deir al-Balah, where we've had scenes of people pitching makeshift tents, putting up sheets of plastic on patches of open ground anywhere that's not already inhabited. And the same thing also in Rafah, where the UN says another 100,000 people have arrived just in the past few days. And this is a city on the border with Egypt that's already become the most densely populated area of anywhere in the Gaza Strip because of all the displaced people who've gathered there.
And what about this peace initiative in Cairo?
Well, this is an important development, but we're being very cautious about it. Egypt and Qatar, of course, have been these key mediators for Israel and Hamas, but we haven't really seen much progress since last month's week-long truce collapsed, which saw Israeli hostages being freed in exchange for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. We understand there are Hamas officials now in Cairo and that the plan involves new renewable ceasefires, staggered hostages release in exchange for more Palestinian prisoners. The Egyptians saying that this could potentially lead to a full ceasefire.
Yolan Nell. A second U.S. state has barred Donald Trump from running to be the Republican Party's candidate in the presidential election next year. Maine, in the northeast of America, has joined Colorado in disqualifying him. The decision was made by Maine's Secretary of State, Shenna Bellows.
I hope that the United States Supreme Court will settle this matter nationwide. That being said, every Secretary of State must uphold the election laws in their state. The events of January 6th were tragic and unprecedented, and the evidence presented in the hearing before me that I was duty-bound to rule upon indicated that January 6th, 2021, was in fact an insurrection, and Mr. Trump did in fact engage in that insurrection.
Well, the matter is bound to go to the Supreme Court, as our Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue told the BBC's Oliver Conway.
This ruling is a sort of preliminary one in Maine. In other words, it has to go through the whole court process. The Secretary of State, who's said that Donald Trump can't go on the primary, is the senior election official, but there's still a process of appeal that can take place. But I think it adds to the position we've got in Colorado, where the Supreme Court there, the state Supreme Court, has already said that Mr. Trump's name shouldn't appear on the ballot. Having said that, there have been some other states that have said, no, we don't buy this constitutional argument that someone allegedly involved in insurrection is ineligible to run for office. And that is why, as you alluded to in your introduction there, that this will inevitably have to end up at the United States Supreme Court, which, quite honestly, Ollie, is going to be one of the most momentous cases and decisions it's going to have to make in years.
Yeah, when is that likely to happen, and what might the US Supreme Court do?
Well, it's got to happen pretty soon, because the primary elections, at any rate, get underway on the 15th of January in Iowa. So they come pretty thick and fast in the coming months, and the court will be cognizant of that. So there'll be a lot of pressure on the justices in the Supreme Court to take up the case. The Republicans in Colorado, the Republican Party has already asked the Supreme Court, the US Supreme Court, to take up the case. We haven't heard any details about when or how they plan to do that. They'd have to take oral arguments, don't forget. They'd then go away and think about it for a bit, but they will be under pressure to get this thing sorted pretty quick. And of course, it comes at a time when they're not just being asked to adjudicate on whether Donald Trump is ineligible to run for the presidency under this element of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment. But they're also going to be asked by a special counsel whether it's okay to prosecute Donald Trump on criminal charges as a former president for alleged crimes committed while he was president. So there's a couple of great big stonking constitutional questions that those nine justices, six more conservative leanings, three more liberal leanings, are going to have to decide in really quite short order.
Gary O'Donoghue. Russia is holding an election next year too, but only one candidate has a realistic chance. Our Russia editor, Stephen Rosenberg, reports on how hopes of democracy have faded since the end of the Soviet Union.
It was December 1993, and I was sitting in my flat in Moscow watching what must have been one of the first ever election night results shows on Russian television for a parliamentary election. That night, as well as electing a new parliament, the Duma, Russians also approved a new constitution. The constitution, which many years later Vladimir Putin would change through a referendum to give himself the chance of 12 more years in power. I can tell you now, pretty much, what the result of next March's Russian presidential election will be. Vladimir Putin will win, and with a landslide. Russia's current political system is Putin's political system. His rules, his election. And although his will not be the only name on the ballot, the president's most high-profile opponents have either fled into exile or been put in prison. What's more, the Kremlin controls television. Vladimir Putin receives lots of airtime. And on TV, he's much praised never criticized.
Alexander
is a young TV reporter from northeastern Russia. At Vladimir Putin's end-of-year press conference recently, he stood up and declared, "We all support your decision to run in next year's election because you've been in power for as long as I can remember." There are many Russians, like Alexander, who simply cannot imagine anyone else in the Kremlin. Not because they idolise Vladimir Putin. They just see no alternative to him. I've often heard people here say, "Well, if not Putin, who then?" The Kremlin has engineered that. It has cleared the political landscape of any potential challengers to the man who has ruled Russia as president or prime minister for nearly a quarter of a century, to make sure that those two words, that little question, who then, is left unanswered. Even the war in Ukraine, and what are believed to be huge Russian military losses, don't appear to have sparked disillusionment in Russia's president and commander-in-chief. Some Russians believe that at a time of war, it is their duty to back their leader, without questioning his motives or the consequences. Crucially, the other thing you find a lot of here is indifference. Many Russians don't seem to care who's in power in the Kremlin. They just hunker down in their town or village and try to get through life as best they can.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Still to come on this podcast.
3, 2, 1. Engines full power. And liftoff.
A robot space plane takes to the skies, but what will it mean for travel in the future?
Remarkable personal stories.
Betrayal. It runs through my life and runs through my story.
Deep dive documentaries.
These children are using their own bags, not to carry books, but they carry the drug markets in Sweden on their shoulders.
And sport, but not as you know it.
There's this massive landslide of myth, and somewhere in there is the truth.
The BBC World Service tells the world stories. Search for Lives Less Ordinary, The Documentary, and Amazing Sports Stories, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
To Burundi now, where even though homosexuality in the country is already illegal, the president has gone a step further and now says homosexuals should be stoned to death in public. I asked our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, what's going on?
President Ndishimaye was speaking to journalists and he said, "I think if we find these people," and he meant gay people, "in Burundi, they should be taken to stadiums and be stoned, and doing so would not be a crime." He went on to say that homosexuality is like choosing between Satan and God. And he said, "If you want to choose Satan, then go and live in those countries which allow homosexuality and basically remain there and don't come back." And then he said that Burundi should not bow to Western donors and international pressure over this issue. And he said if they did, then they should keep their aid, in his words.
This is a wider issue, though, isn't it, Richard?
Yeah, very much so. The most notable case was in Uganda. In May, President Museveni signed into law the Anti-Homosexuality Act, which is one of the world's harshest. That proposes the death penalty for what they call aggravated homosexuality, which is, for example, having same sex with a minor. It also proposes life imprisonment for homosexual acts. Similarly, in Kenya, some MPs are pushing for a law to be like Uganda. It's already illegal there. And MPs in Ghana have also voted to amend their anti-gay legislation. It's called the Promotion of Proper Human Sexual Rights and Ghanaian Family Values Bill. This proposes 3 years prison sentence for anyone identifying as LGBTQ+, and 10 years for promoting homosexuality. It's thought that this rise in anti-gay feelings has been promoted by American evangelical groups, which have been pushing their agenda, including the Mormon Church. Although the US is also threatening to pull aid out of places like Uganda because of this. So it's sort of pulling both ways. And it's created a schism in the Anglican Church. But I have to say there are a few African countries where the direction's going in the other way. So, for example, in Angola, Gabon and Botswana, they have all decriminalised homosexuality.
Richard Hamilton. The authorities in India have issued a red alert for dense fog in the capital Delhi and the neighbouring states of Punjab and Haryana. Visibility has dropped to less than 50 metres in many places, and people have been advised not to travel unless absolutely essential. On Thursday, more than 100 flights and 20 trains in the capital were delayed, and road accidents have been reported in parts of northern India. Among those peering through the fog is our very own South Asia editor, Anbarasan Etharajan, and asked him what it's like in Delhi.
Well, I'm at Connaught Place, also called as Rajiv Chowk, in the Indian capital Delhi, a busy and a bustling commercial area with full of cars and other vehicles. Now, the fog has cleared a bit because it is afternoon here, a bit of wind. But this morning it was pretty bad when we were travelling and the visibility was pretty less. And this is the first time this season the government is saying about red alert because the fog was dense. And we also hear from friends and colleagues who were at the airport that their flights have been delayed by several hours. And it has been happening for the last 4 or 5 days. And the Met officials here say that the situation is likely to continue till the end of this month, up to 1st of January. But it is basically during from midnight up until 10 or 11 a.m. in the morning, and that is also causing lots of accidents on the motorways or the highways leading outside the capital Delhi and also going to other northern Indian states.
Well, you're there. I can hear the cars and vehicles behind you. I mean, is it really dangerous to drive, do you think, with this fog?
That's what the authorities say. Avoid travel during the night or early in the morning. Travel much later. But in the city, it is fine because you can see lots of things here. Whereas if you're on the highway in the countryside, then the fog doesn't clear that much. What they say is, you know, during night when the land gets really cool, then the water vapor, because the air cannot contain that much moisture, the water vapor causes this fog. And in addition to that, industrial and vehicle pollution that is adding to the fog that is also worsening the air quality. And also in Punjab and in Haryana states, we also hear about these accidents because of the less visibility. But thousands of people have been stranded because they have to wait for several hours. Many trains from Delhi to other parts of India, long distance trains, have also been delayed. And the authorities say that till the 1st of January, the situation will be like this, even though fog is normal at this point of time. But this year they are saying that for several days it is causing disruption.
And Barasan Itharajan in Delhi. And in Florida.
3, 2, 1. Engine full power and liftoff. Falcon 9, Perfectionist, Falcon Heavy, go USSR52.
That was the sound of the US military's secretive X-37B robot space plane finally blasting off after a series of false starts and delays. The size of a small bus, it's like a mini space shuttle, but few know what technology or experiments are contained within. The launch came 2 weeks after China launched its own robot space plane called Shenlong, or Divine Dragon. The BBC's Nick Robinson has been speaking to Juliana Suess, the policy lead for space at the think tank RUSI.
There's a whole lot we don't know about this program. This is now the seventh launch of X-37B. It's a reusable spacecraft. So you can kind of imagine it a little bit like NASA's space shuttle, but a lot smaller and highly robotic. We know that it usually operates in lower Earth orbit around between 300 and 400 kilometers up. And we know that its mission now will sort of focus on trying new orbital regimes, though the specific orbit is classified. It will look at future space domain assessment technology, which is very important considering our orbits are continuing to sort of fill up with further assets. But it will also look at radiation effects on materials. We know that there will be some seeds on board to sort of try and see the effect of sort of a long-term space mission on seeds, which obviously may have an impact later on if we are actually trying to explore further planets, etc. Because actually, X-37B last time stayed in orbit for nearly 2.5 years. We don't know quite how long long it will be in orbit for this time, but we know it will be a prolonged period of time.
I mentioned the Chinese had just launched one of their own. Should we see this as part of the space race?
I think what we're seeing specifically when we talk about these spacecraft, which are obviously highly classified on them, both sides, both China and the US, I think it's definitely part of a security dilemma we're seeing. And I think the sort of classification level here is really helping. We've seen a whole lot of conspiracy theories about what X-37B might be able to do. Given the sort of size and limited maneuverability of the spacecraft, I think most of those conspiracy theories we can sort of reject straight away. But I think it's the classification hasn't really helped in this. And obviously, neither the US or China can sort of collaborate substantively on space. And that's because of the Wolf Amendment that was passed in the US in 2011, which prohibits NASA from actually using government funds for collaboration with China. And there's only been very specific allowances made to actually make collaboration possible, for example, to allow monitoring of a Chinese moon lander.
Juliana Suess from Russie. With summer now in full swing in South Africa, many are heading to the beach for the holidays. But there's concern with great white shark sightings on the rise and a recent spike in fatal attacks. The BBC has been examining the measures being taken to keep people and sharks apart while protecting both from harm. Daniel de Simone sent us this report from Cape Town.
I'm on Muizenberg Beach, which is one of the biggest beaches in Cape Town. And there's lots of children in the sea, there's lots of families, surfers, and there used to be a lot of sightings of great white sharks in this area. But then there went several years where there weren't any sightings at all until a week ago.
So I think it's good that we're seeing a lot of natural life returning. In terms of the people's safety, I think obviously it can be a bit worrying. I mean, who won't be worried? I think we got it under control.
So I don't like sharks. That's why I'm sitting on the beach always. I don't go into the water.
So we know there are sharks, but we still swim. We just try to swim at beaches that we think are safe.
Fishhook Mountain from Muizenberg Mountain.
Watching from the surrounding mountainside is a team of professional shark spotters, including Dennis Chikozi.
I'm checking for the movement in the water. From here, I have to see whatever is coming, be it fish, sharks, dolphins or whales.
A sighting means an alert and the sea cleared of swimmers. Each morning, the team seeks to create a safe bathing area off one beach with a 350-metre net. It's placed down to the seabed and across the bay, where there's previously been fatal shark attacks.
Can you see, there's the skirting part of it, there's the bottom line.
I join the team in their boat, bathers bobbing up and down in the water on the safe side of the net. And how close can the sharks come in this bay we're in now?
Yo, like close, they're coming inshore, like waist deep already, they're coming close.
The net is lifted each evening to avoid injuring or killing sea life. Up the coast at Plettenberg Bay, the shark spotters were called in after two fatal attacks last year. They've since made over 70 great white shark sightings. Head of the shark spotters is Sarah Voris.
And so when you have two fatalities in a short space of time in a short geographical area, it can have really significant impact, social impact on economic and environmental. And so putting measures in place like shark spotters, increasing education is really important for those areas that have been affected by shark bites.
I love this picture. That's why we put it on the mural.
One of those killed in Plettenberg Bay by a shark was Kimon Bisogno, who ran a pizza restaurant with her partner, Diego Milesi.
She was very bright, bright in personality, big smile on her face, playful and kind and with a big, big heart.
She was the second person to die in the area last year. Only then were shark spotting measures put in place.
Daniel de Simone in South Africa. Switzerland may be about to clamp down on some high-profile luxury consumption. Voters will be asked to decide whether to ban imports of furs and pâté de foie gras. That's after campaigners handed in enough signatures to trigger a public vote on the issues. As Terry Egan reports.
Boxes were piled up outside the Federal Palace Parliament buildings in the capital, Bern. They symbolised well over 100,000 signatures each for initiatives on imports of foie gras and on imports of fur. Foie gras involves the force-feeding of ducks and geese. It's widely consumed around the December holiday season, which gives the campaign extra resonance. While such force feeding has been banned in Switzerland for more than 40 years, importing produce derived from it is not. And according to the Swiss Animal Alliance, with 200 tons of foie gras imported annually, Switzerland is one of the main importers of this product. In fact, every year, 400,000 ducks and 12,000 geese are killed in order to meet the demand. As for the vote on fur, the Swiss Animal Alliance denounces methods of breeding and killing it says are considered cruelty punishable by criminal sanctions in Switzerland. Still, 350 tons of fur, it claims, are imported each year. And that corresponds to the slaughter of 1.5 million animals.
Terry Egan. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Wozechka. The producer was David Lewis. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.